Intellectual Muscle, University Dialogues for Vancouver 2010. They like us. They really like us. Defining Canada through international accomplishments. How Canada's identity has been affected by our Olympic accomplishments is the topic addressed by Dr. Matthew Hayday of the Department of History at the University of Guelph.
Identity. Our sense of who we are, it shapes the way we carry out our day-to-day activities and experience events. Thought about in collective terms, our national culture and identity also affects the way we think about the way our country functions, and of its role in the world. I want to start off this talk about the changing politics of Canadian identity with two brief images. The first image comes from 1984. Gaëtan Boucher, a speed skater from Quebec, proudly carried the Canadian flag at the opening ceremonies of the Sarajevo Winter Olympics. A couple of weeks later, he would be heralded at home in Canada for winning three of Canada's four medals at the Games, two of them gold. Following Boucher's victories, former Quebec Premier René Lévesque reportedly said, "Quebec 3, Canada 0." Boucher later responded, "I don't compete for French Canada or English Canada, but Canada as a whole." The second image is from 25 years later, in 2009, as the venues for the Vancouver Whistler Olympics were in the final stages of construction. A controversy erupted in the Canadian media over signage at the Richmond Oval because local organizers, including the mayor of Richmond, did not want the Oval to have its signage in both English and French, the two official languages both of Canada and of the Olympic movement. Many Canadians writing on various news websites argued that it didn't make any sense to have French signage in British Columbia and suggested that this was yet another example of a federal government trying to force bilingualism where it doesn't belong. Both of these images speak to the very complicated politics surrounding how Canadians have conceived of their national identity, and how this identity has evolved in the years since the Second World War. Visitors to Canada during the build-up to the Olympics, if they watch our media or check out our bookstores, might be surprised at the extent of Canada's identity complex. They would see book titles including The Unfinished Canadian, The Accidental Canadian, A Fair Country Telling Truths About Canada, and Who We Are. They'd see television ads run that were questioning the Canadianness of Liberal opposition leader Michael Ignatieff. They would see news stories decrying the fact that Canadians don't know their history and fretting about what that means for Canada's future. A few years ago, they would have seen the I Am Canadian ads from Molson Beer. Being secure about who we are is a national sport in Canada, or perhaps it's better to call it a collective psychological disorder. Faced with this question about who we are, successive Canadian governments and opinion leaders have attempted to shape Canada's sense of self through various policies and programs. Some have worked, while others have crashed on the rocky shores of Canada's internal divisions. But certainly they have had an impact. A visitor to Canada in the 1930s would not have had the same impression of Canada as they would have during the 1976 Montreal Olympics, and a return visitor in 2010 would likely discern yet another Canada. Canada's sense of itself has changed over these decades in a number of significant ways, and a succession of governments have tried to respond to these changes by crafting new national identity policies to hold the country together. And indeed, a visitor to Canada during the Vancouver Olympics will most likely, if they watch or read our news, bear witness to a very self-confident and assured nation, at least if we're winning medals. And although this is likely the case for most countries, I would argue that in Canada, international accomplishment and recognition of the success of individual Canadians has come to be a crucial element of our identity politics, a rare unifying element in a postmodern, individualistic, and divided settler state. Because there is nothing particularly natural or self-evident about nationalisms or national identities. Indeed, there's an extensive scholarship on how these identities are very deliberately constructed social and political entities, or, as Benedict Anderson called them, imagined communities. What Anderson was describing with this term is the situation whereby, as citizens of a country, we imagine that we have fundamental characteristics in common with our fellow citizens, and in many cases we are prepared to fight and even to die on their behalf, even though we will never meet the vast majority of these people in person. In Canada, the defining characteristics of what make up this national community have changed substantially over the past several decades. Were you to ask an average resident of Ontario or British Columbia or Nova Scotia in the 1930s to define Canada, they would likely have spoken about it as being a Christian, meaning Protestant, community, a parliamentary democracy with close ties to Great Britain and the Commonwealth, and with the underlying implication that its population was white, although this wouldn't have been explicitly mentioned. In Quebec, a francophone respondent might have given you a slightly different answer because this person would also have spoken about the Catholic, French-speaking communities that also made up the country. In the decade following the Second World War, these assumptions about Canada would be called into question. Canada's population mix shifted rapidly in the three decades following the war, partly because of the baby boom, but also because of a major new wave of new immigration, and immigration from new source countries. In the 1950s, Canada accepted millions of immigrants, particularly from Southern Europe. And in the 1960s, as Canada dropped its racial quotas on immigration, it became home to large populations from Southern and Eastern Asia, the Caribbean, and other parts of the developing world. On another front, while French-speaking Canadians had always constituted over a quarter of Canada's population, this fact had never really filtered into the consciousness of English Canadians. And that, too, started to change in the 1960s, as Quebec's Quiet Revolution brought assertive new political and cultural leaders to the forefront, demanding recognition of their culture and of their language. Aboriginal Canadians had also long been ignored, and were expected under the terms of the Indian Act to abandon their cultures and to assimilate into Euro-Canadian lifestyles. But these communities, too, signaled in the late 1960s and into the 1970s that they were no longer going to accept this third-class treatment by the Canadian government. And Canada's place in the world was changing as well. The Second World War had greatly weakened the United Kingdom, and Canada more and more found itself in the orbit of the United States, which had emerged as the dominant power in the Cold War Western Alliance. Canada was shedding its role as a follower of British foreign policy and attempting to carve out a distinctive role for itself, a highlight of which was the role it played in creating a peacekeeping force during the Suez Crisis of 1956. And finally, culturally, American television was having a marked impact on the entertainment of Canadians, while economically, Canada and the United States were growing ever more intertwined. So what did all of these post-war changes mean for Canadian nationalism and for its national identity? Canada's British-centric identity was undergoing a serious challenge in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Our Prime Minister at the time, John Diefenbaker, was greatly dismayed at this development. His government attempted to shore up Canada's British connections. He tried, for example, to build a closer trade relationship with the United Kingdom. On a cultural level, he tried to revive symbolic markers of Canada's British connection, including the organization of Dominion Day celebrations on Parliament Hill and on the CBC, which played up the role of the Governor General and of the military. But Diefenbaker's efforts did little to slow down these changes. And so, philosopher George Grant, in his classic work, Lament for a Nation, contended that Diefenbaker's failures were symptomatic of a broader passing of a conservative, British, Christian Canada, which was bound to be swallowed up by the liberal, individualistic, consumerist culture of the United States. Others were less convinced that this passing of a British-centered Canada was necessarily a bad thing, or that the future had to be a completely Americanized Canada. Starting in the mid-1960s, the liberal governments of Lester Pearson and his successor Pierre Trudeau started recrafting the way that the Canadian government presented Canada to its citizens in an effort to foster national unity among these new and vocal components of the country. Part of this was done through the politics of recognition. In 1963, Pearson launched the Royal Commission on Bilingualism and Biculturalism, which would lead to Canada's Official Languages Act in 1969, recognizing English and French as the country's two official languages. Rather than opting for biculturalism, Trudeau's government put forth a policy of multiculturalism in 1971, contending that all Canadians were free to maintain the cultures of their countries of origin if they so desired, while also participating in a bilingual Canada. After an ill-fated attempt to eliminate special status for Aboriginals with the White Paper of 1969, the federal government shifted gears and began land claim negotiations and direct funding of Aboriginal lobby groups. And there was also the start of an emphasis on new cultural symbols. In 1965, the maple leaf became Canada's official flag, replacing the red ensign, which had the British Union Jack in the corner. So what was the impact of these politics of recognizing diversity? While many groups were pleased to finally be recognized as part of this revamped Canadian identity, others were less pleased. This emphasis on diversity was challenged by many Canadians who wanted greater national unity. They pointed to the regional divisions that had come to the forefront by the 1970s, most notably with Quebec separatism in the lead-up to the referendum of 1980, but also with Western alienation. and bilingualism in particular, was hard to sell in much of English-speaking Canada. A so-called bilingual backlash viewed this as the first step to making Canada an exclusively French-speaking country, something they thought should be avoided at all costs. So while federal policymakers and cultural elites did not want to abandon this new focus on inclusion and diversity as the basis for a revamped national identity, diversity on its own was proving difficult to use as a rallying cry for a national culture. With this in mind, the Canadian government increased its emphasis on developing and promoting new and somewhat abstracted symbols of nationhood. So in addition to the maple leaf flag, O Canada was officially adopted as the national anthem in 1980, replacing God Save the Queen. The British-associated Dominion Day was renamed Canada Day in 1982, and the federal government pumped funding into local celebrations of Canada Day, intending to use this national holiday as an occasion to foster national pride and recognition of these new Canadian symbols. And perhaps most notably, the Trudeau government spent the first 3 years of the 1980s pushing through the ratification of a new Canadian constitution, which contained the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. In conjunction with the development of new unifying symbols of Canadian nationhood, a second prong of the development of national unity focused on Canadian achievement. For while symbols were all well and good, it's probably fair to say that Canada has had a bit of an inferiority complex in relation to the United States. It is almost cliched to say that the definition of Canada, at least in recent decades, was to say that it was not American. A key way of adding more meaningful content to what Canadian diversity and openness could accomplish was to draw Canadians' attention to the accomplishments of their fellow citizens. To give you some examples of how this worked in practice, let's consider how this emphasis on Canadian achievement was reflected in a new thrust of Canada Day celebrations from the 1980s, 1990s, and onwards. These celebrations were changed from entertainment-oriented musical variety shows to a format which much more explicitly showcased the achievements of Canadians. Annual themes were built into these celebrations to allow promoters of Canada Day to showcase Canadian accomplishments in exploration, in the arts, in science and technology. They did this with promotional materials such as children's activity books and by weaving these themes through speeches from politicians and the Governor General. And ultimately, they would add a special Canadian Achievers component to the Canada Day celebrations on Parliament Hill, whereby Canadians with internationally recognized accomplishments could be celebrated. The achievers came from a variety of different sectors, including science, medicine, and the arts. But beyond these sectors, there was certainly tremendous public response to those individuals with achievement in international sport. Several of the featured Canadians in 1985's Young Achievers activity books were athletes, including sprinter Percy Williams, figure skater Barbara Ann Scott, diver Sylvie Bernier, kayaker Alwyn Morris, and marathoner Tom Longboat. 13 of the 32 featured achievers were athletes. They were men, women, Anglophone, Francophone, Aboriginal, but all were being celebrated for their accomplishments as young Canadians. Olympians in particular tended to be prominently featured in Canada Day celebrations. Silver medal-winning figure skater Elizabeth Manley was prominently featured in 1988, along with bronze medal-winning pairs skaters Tracy Wilson and Rob McCall. And Manley would later be asked to co-host the 1989 festivities. A decade later, three-time world champion and Olympic silver medalist figure skater Elvis Stoiko hosted the 1998 Canada Day show. Olympic and Paralympic medal winners past and present were an almost continuous feature of every Canada Day from the late 1980s onward, and were particularly prominently featured in Olympic years, or in the year immediately following an Olympics. This Olympic achievement theme crossed over into other elements of Canada Day celebrations. For example, David Foster did a live performance of his composition Winter Games, the theme music of the 1988 Calgary Olympics. In their speeches, politicians lauded Canada's international triumphs in sports. This was perhaps most notable in 1996, when the Canada Day ceremony featured a special ceremony in which Prime Minister Jean Chrétien added his signatures to those of the 50,000 Canadians who had signed a Spirit of Sport book to be presented to the team at the Atlanta Olympics. Accomplishment in sport was one key component, therefore, in a general attempt to draw the attention of Canadians to their fellow Canadians' accomplishments on the international stage. In speeches, Canadian Prime Ministers spoke of Canada's reputation for peacekeeping and as a welcoming country for immigrants. And in every year when he could, Jean Chrétien touted the fact that the United Nations had ranked Canada the number one place in the world in which to live, to the wild applause of the audience. So what was all of this attention on Canadian achievement intending to accomplish, and was it working? In a country splintered along regional, linguistic, and ethnic lines, celebrating diversity and tolerance provided the basis for an inclusive national identity. And certainly the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms came to assume great symbolic prominence, particularly in English-speaking Canada, as the embodiment of those values. But as a vehicle for national pride, diversity alone was proving insufficient as a rallying force for Canadians, especially when the country was racked with constitutional turmoil, fights over language rights, and tensions over the meaning of multiculturalism. With this new emphasis on achievement, particularly achievements that had been recognized on the world stage, Canadian governments and opinion leaders were attempting to shift the ways that Canadians thought about their country. Rather than dwelling on the differences between provinces and language communities, they could take pride in and rally behind the excellence that this system of diversity could produce. Achievers were not being celebrated as representatives of the Québécois, of the Cree Nation, or of Alberta, but as Canadians with world-class accomplishments. It was a shift from what we might think of as a navel-gazing reflection on Canada's constituent elements to instead viewing the country from the outside, reveling in how others have recognized Canadians for their achievement on both an individual and national level. As such, Vancouverites, Calgarians, Torontonians, Montréalais, and Haligonians could all celebrate the Olympic victories of a Gaétan Boucher or an Éric Bédard in speed skating, and consider those victories to be a source of Canadian national pride. We're left with a rather ironic situation. These individual Canadians are celebrated for their triumphs and held up as national icons, as the individual pillars of an identity oriented around international achievement. And yet, were a Gaétan Boucher competing in Vancouver, Canada in 2010, rather than in Sarajevo, Yugoslavia in 1984, his gold medal wins might well have come in the Richmond Skating Oval, the same oval that did not want to have signage in his first language of French and one of the two official languages of our country. While the rhetoric of a diverse, bilingual, multicultural Canada has certainly been a key part of efforts to recast Canada's national cultural identity since the Second World War, there is still clearly a ways to go before these facets of our national identity gain as much acceptance as the focus on the individual achievements of Canadians. Now, as to the question of whether forging a national identity centered around either the individual accomplishments of its citizens or a discourse of diversity and tolerance is the ideal route to follow, that is the subject for a much larger and ongoing national conversation.
Intellectual Muscle was developed by Vancouver 2010, UBC Continuing Studies in collaboration with universities across Canada, and The Globe and Mail.